From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The Australian economy is now suffering from slow growth. Consumption is weak, business investment is flagging, and workers have been getting little in the way of wage increases. The Reserve Bank has cut interest rates, already at historic lows, three times this year. But many argue that monetary policy has now reached its limit as a lever and fiscal stimulus is needed. However, the government is reluctant to do anything that will impinge on the projected surplus, which has become a political icon. One question is whether or how long the government can maintain this position, or whether it will have to change course if the September quarter growth figures, which come out in December, are poor. The other question is whether action should be taken now and what that action should be. Ross Gittins is the economics editor for the Sydney Morning Herald, and he joins us today to discuss these issues. Ross Gittins, can we start with a snapshot of the economy? Is it in very poor shape, or are the problems being exaggerated?
It's in very poor shape. It's not necessarily on the verge of recession, but if things were allowed to continue to slow down, we'd certainly be very vulnerable to any kind of adverse shock from the rest of the world. It's more likely that rather than actually go into recession, without a push from the rest of the world, it's more likely that unless the economy picks up, it will stay growing very weakly and unemployment will continue to rise as it's begun to rise.
Are the problems being driven from overseas or are they homegrown?
I think they're homegrown. I think there are problems overseas. They're obvious, the trade war and all the rest of it. But we've got these problems. They're inside our economy. It's not the rest of the world that's causing our wages growth to be so weak. Wages growth is a big part of the reason why consumer spending is weak. Our retail traders are doing it really tough. And at a time when the economy is growing weakly, you also aren't giving businesses much incentive to go out and expand their investment. Having said that it's all kind of inside Australia, what I have to also add is that very similar weakness is occurring in other developed economies.
And what's the basic reason or reasons for these internal problems? Diving more deeply.
That's something that economists are still debating, really. This is a great puzzle that economists are turning their mind to all around the world and coming up with different and rival explanations. But one of the things is that interest rates are so low because people in the Western world are saving a lot more than they used to, and that includes more people who are saving for retirement because of the aging of the population. But also businesses aren't investing in the way that they have in the past. And you could say, well, since they don't see a great prospect for strong growth, why would they invest? And that's not a bad argument. But a lot of the problem comes from weak business investment and also the fact that productivity, that is output per hour worked, it's weak. It's weak all around the world and it's weak in Australia. But even so, our wages aren't growing as strongly as you would expect them to.
Now, you've written that the developed economies just don't work in the way that they used to in the 1980s. Why don't the old rules apply anymore?
Well, one of the big changes is that we don't have a problem with inflation. We went through the 70s and the 80s and part of the 90s really worried about inflation. If you let the economy grow too strongly, then you'd get in a terrible inflation, and you'd have to kind of hit the economy on the head to get it back to not growing so rapidly and get prices not rising so rapidly. That was a problem that we had in the old days, in the previous century. It's a problem that we haven't had and certainly haven't had since the global financial crisis in 2008. There is no problem with inflation. And the surprising thing, the one good thing about this, is that employment has grown reasonably strongly. But even so, there's no oomph in the economy. And people have lots of explanations for that. And I can't tell you a simple explanation as to why all the other countries are grappling with the same problem we are, other developed countries.
Lots of assumptions seem to have changed. For example, years ago we assumed that 5% unemployment was in fact full employment. Now we have around 5% unemployment, and yet the Reserve Bank and others say we've got to get it down further.
Well, they say that it's probably their estimate of where full employment is, by which they mean how low can unemployment go before you start having problem with excessive wage growth. They've gone for many years saying it's about 5%. Now they're saying it's about 4.5%. They probably could just as easily say it's 4%. But this estimate of where full employment is falling in all the developed countries. It's another manifestation of the way things have changed. And I'm sure it's linked to two things. One is the fact that no one has an inflation problem anymore, and that there's not much growth in wages. Even in America, which has been the strongest growing of the developed economies, they haven't had very strong growth in wages, and certainly not until quite recently. Now, that's a worry. And we used to think that whatever, in Australia, you ask about what's changed, one of the rules that's changed is we used to think that if productivity was improving, the productivity of labour was improving, that would be reflected in wages rising by the same amount faster than inflation, real wages growth being very closely tied to how much productivity was improving. That hasn't happened. It's not happening. We're getting a bit of productivity growth. We're getting more than most of the other countries, but it's not showing up in wages growing by a percent or a percent and a half a year faster than prices are. And when you get that happening, you can't get growth in the economy if the largest single source of income in the economy, wages, isn't growing much in real terms.
Now, in terms of what is being done and has been done, we've seen interest rates already at record low levels cut three times this year. How much further can monetary policy be taken as a lever?
I don't think it can be taken much further at all. They might have one, possibly two more small rate cuts still in their locker, but I don't believe the Reserve Bank will actually cut interest rates, the official interest rate that they control. I don't believe they'll cut it to zero. They'll stop when it gets to about a half or maybe a quarter, because there's no great advantage in having it that low. Another part of this story is that cuts in interest rates at this level don't give the economy the boost that they used to. That's another big change. You might get the same cut. We've had a cut of 0.75 percentage point in the official interest rate, but nobody's really expecting that that will do much to boost the economy, which is the reason why the governor keeps saying that he wants help from the budget, which what economists call fiscal policy.
Well, I must say that the Governor, Philip Lowe, has sent out mixed messages. He has, in a number of speeches, indicated the need for some fiscal stimulus. And yet, when he was in the United States recently, he was predicting that Australia would return to trend growth soon, which is around 3%, and sort of suggesting that things were hunky-dory, at least more so than in his previous speeches. What do you make of what he's saying?
Have you heard of the stiff upper lip? Central bank governors are experts at it. However worried they are, they exude confidence at all times. And that's because if you've got a central bank governor who's running around saying, I'm very worried, then everybody else will be very worried too.
But he seemed to be very worried, or at least somewhat worried, earlier on.
Yes, so you're right. His message has been a bit inconsistent, but that's because he's very anxious not to talk the economy down. And he's right. The governor of the Reserve Bank and the Treasurer shouldn't be talking the economy down, because what they say gets taken far more seriously than what pipsqueaks like I say.
Do you think that the government should in fact be injecting some stimulus now? And if so, what form should that take?
I think they should. I think that we've got quite a problem. There is absolutely no certainty that the interest rate, the tax cuts or the interest rate cuts will give the economy much of a boost. And so I think that it all gets down to a stitch in time saves nine. The earlier you step in to try and boost things and cheer people up, the less problem you'll end up having. The longer you leave it, the more things unravel and the bigger the task. I have no doubt that the situation is quite serious. It's not actually at recession levels, but it's at levels where the economy is going to be very weak and people aren't going to get decent pay rises. And unemployment is going to be creeping up. And the best thing to do about that is to get in now and spend some money. Now, one of the simple ways that the government could give the economy a boost is to do as various people are advocating, and that is increase the New Start allowance, the unemployment allowance, because those people are on they're on the breadline. Any cent you give them will find its way into the shops very, very quickly. And that's important. Now, they're only a small part of the economy, but anything you do for them will help to get the economy moving. Another thing that the government could do is undertake a program of building social housing, what we used to call housing commission in the old days. The beauty of that is that it would spread through a lot of electorates. It wouldn't just be some big infrastructure program, some big expressway that was just in a part of the economy. And that would help. But there are other things. The governor has suggested that, well, the government has been saying, well, look, you know, we've got some big projects already going, and if we're not careful, we'll have shortages of building labour and so on. The governor's answer to that is the government could encourage the states, you know, bribe the states, to get on with much smaller infrastructure projects, and even to put more money into maintenance. One of the things politicians are very prone to is not adequately maintaining the existing infrastructure, because there's no ribbon to cut when you spend that. And in fact, if you neglect a piece of existing infrastructure, then you have to completely replace it. And when you do, there's a ribbon to cut.
What about money put into helping in drought relief? Because obviously the government's going to do something here in the next few weeks.
Yes. Well, I think one of the problems when you're trying to stimulate the economy is that if too much of it is saved rather than spent, you don't have an immediate effect. You might get a delayed effect. You don't have an immediate effect. Any money spent to help people with the drought not much of that would be saved. It would go through the system and perk up the retailers and the other businesses around the place, all of whom are providing employment to Australians. But having said that, I also think we ought to be putting much more thought, not just of helping people because of this drought, which is worth doing, but it's really helping the bush adjust to a situation where, thanks to climate change, we're going to have a lot more droughts. They're going to be more severe and they're going to be more frequent. And so if we're spending really big money, then we ought to spend it carefully in ways that help farm sector adjust to a much tougher climate in which to grow things.
I know you've said a stitch in time, but just to be a devil's advocate on this question of immediate fiscal stimulus, isn't it fair enough for the government to say, well, the next growth figures, the September quarter national accounts, are only a few weeks away? Wouldn't it be sensible to wait until we see those before reacting?
It would be sensible to be making plans now so that if, when we see those numbers in a few weeks' time, the government can respond quickly rather than just saying, oh, well, okay, we've seen these numbers. The economy has been weak for a fifth quarter in a row, which makes us think that it won't be taking off anytime soon. And so now that we're convinced of that, we start thinking about what we could do. So now, I'm not saying you've got to announce it before you see the next figures for how strongly the economy is growing, but I am saying that if you're governing the place wisely, you would have your contingency plans ready. And if, when we see those numbers, they're much stronger than we feared, great. We put our plans back on the shelf till we need them.
Now, just on another tack, we're heading into a big debate about superannuation. Do you think the government will try to abandon its legislated commitment of taking the super guarantee from 9.5% to 12%? And indeed, do you think it should do that?
The Liberal Party has opposed compulsory superannuation from the outset, and I'd be very surprised if they lost their in principle opposition. They used to say they didn't believe in compelling people to save. One of their problems, which is probably compounded now, is that a lot of the saving that's done through superannuation is done through industry super schemes in which the unions have a say along with the employers, and the Conservative politicians find that very uncomfortable. They've always thought that the capital was being owned and controlled by their side, not the other side. And they also worry that some of all that money might find its way into support for their political opponents at the next election. So I'd be amazed if they don't find some kind of reason, you know, a report that makes the recommendation to say, don't take the compulsory contribution much higher than the present 9.5% of wages. I'd also say that I agree with them. I don't think it needs to be higher. I think one of the problems here is that the union movement, or rather the Labor Party, has, because of its links with the union movement, has got a vested interest in compelling people to save more money, because all the people who run superannuation schemes take a little bite out of every dollar that the government compels the people to save.
Just finally, do you think we need more economic reform? And if so, what form should that take? And is there any prospect of getting it?
You will never, ever find a situation where an economist says we don't need more economic reform. They always say that. Sometimes the need for it is greater than other times. I don't sympathise with a lot of the calls for economic reform, which are really just people saying, I think it'd be really wonderful for the economy if you made me pay less tax. I don't believe that that's always true, and I certainly suspect their motives. But if I was thinking of things that really ought to be done right. I would be talking about education. I'd be talking about it at every level. All of them have got problems. And I'm not saying we need to spend a lot of money on it, but I do think we need to be sure that they're achieving the objectives. I worry a lot about the fact that our young people aren't scoring well on our own tests of how they're going, and comparing this year's nine-year-olds with the nine-year-olds of 5 years ago, or on our international things, where it's not at all clear that we're making progress, and where there seems to be a widening gap between the best students and the worst students. And one of the things I really think would be of great economic value, not just to the humans involved, but to the wider economy, is to do more to ensure that the people who are falling behind can keep up.
Ross Gittins, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from this Conversation podcast. Thank you to my producer, Rashna Farooq. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.